guys, and welcome to episode 208 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I chat with Ryan Glode. Ryan is a licensed mental health counsellor based in Rhode Island, and I got him on the show to talk about family accommodation in OCD treatment. We talk about what is family accommodation, examples of it, how it isn't helpful in the long run, ways to reduce family accommodation, being supportive without accommodating, bringing family members into sessions where appropriate, how family members can support themselves so they can support their loved ones, words of hope, and much, much more. I think this is an important topic. I think the family system can be a very helpful thing in treatment. So hopefully this episode goes some way to strengthening the knowledge base. And without further ado, here is Ryan. On the podcast today, I have Ryan Glode. Ryan is a licensed mental health counsellor at RICBT, a group psychotherapy practice specialising in cognitive behavioural therapy. He is also the president and founder of OCD Rhode Island, an official affiliate of the International OCD Foundation. Welcome to the podcast, Ryan.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. And I always like to get people's, if they have an OCD story, if not, in the therapist's case, what's your... What got you into being a therapist and then treating OCD?
So initially I started working on an inpatient hospital setting where a lot of children, adolescents are being misdiagnosed and not properly diagnosed as having OCD. And I thought it was really interesting. And at the time we had started a partial program for OCD at Bradley Hospital where I was working, and I started to help open that program. And as I was there, I noticed when these children would engage in exposure therapy, you know, which is the evidence-based treatment for OCD, that they would get remarkably better really quick. Mm. And it was astonishing to see how quickly they got better and that there was a treatment that worked.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great to hear. Okay, so today's topic, we're going to talk about family accommodation. I guess before we get into it, what is family accommodation?
So I think the best way to think about family accommodation is it's ways in which family members essentially start to partake in an individual's rituals or help them avoid situations that make them anxious. And this can look like providing them means to escape anxiety-provoking situations, providing them reassurance, like answering questions about whether or not their thoughts of worry are going to happen, or engaging in behaviors in order to make the other person feel less anxious. And, you know, what we do know about OCD is that it doesn't just affect the individual, it really affects the entire family system, and it can really cause a lot of conflict at home.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And why would a family, or why does a why does a family accommodate or get involved in rituals?
I think there's four reasons why families accommodate. And I think the first one is this desire to reduce the family member's distress. And I think that's a natural thing for most people. I think when we see someone we love in distress or feeling really overwhelmed or anxious, our immediate instinct is to do anything we can to make them feel better. And I think that's natural. Yeah. But what we know with OCD is that it doesn't work. It actually prolongs their suffering and makes them more anxious over time. And so the initial reason, I think, is to reduce the family members' distress. But on the other end, you know, it's also to reduce our own personal distress. You know, when you see someone anxious and overwhelmed, we become anxious and overwhelmed. Mm. And if we give in to the demand, right, and give in to OCD and do what OCD wants, we feel better, at least in the temporary moment. And I think the other one is misperceptions of consequences for not accommodating. So, for example, a lot of times there's these myths about anxiety. For example, if I don't do anything to get rid of it, that it will always be there and it will never go away. Or, you know, if I'm a parent of a child, if I don't reassure my child that what they're afraid is going to happen, that either it is going to happen, or my child might get aggressive and might hurt me or hurt themselves. And so those are all really reasons that I think reinforce and motivate people to continue to engage in family accommodation.
Yeah, and it makes sense, you know, as you say, why families would accommodate and get involved, because it is quite scary seeing your loved one kind of going through it and you just want to make things better, or you want to protect yourself or whatever it is.
Exactly.
Okay. And in your like day-to-day work, is this something you see quite a bit when you speak to the families, that they are kind of falling into these patterns?
Yeah, I think it's very common. And I also think it's one of the pieces in treatment that's most overlooked oftentimes when treating children and adolescents with OCD. And it's something I assess for right from the beginning when I meet with families. Because sometimes a child can come into the session and they're like, well, I'm not really ritualizing right now. And then you're like, okay, well, what happens when you're anxious? And they're like, oh, well, my mom or dad does this for me. Or, you know, if it's a partner, it's like my spouse checks all the locks before I go to bed at night so I don't have to. So what happens is the family member is essentially actually performing the rituals on behalf of the other individual. So the other person's less distressed, but now the partner or the parent is the one actually engaging in the OCD behavior.
Yeah, so they're kind of continuing the compulsions, and then the person with the OCD doesn't have to. So they're still getting that temporary calming effect that they may get from doing compulsions themselves, but the family are kind of co-doing it effectively.
Yeah.
Okay. No, thank you. And are there any, just to kind of bring it to life, are there any examples that come to mind of, in some of your clients' families, of this family accommodation that may sort of paint a picture?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most common type of family accommodation is actually reassurance. And so reassurance seeking is essentially when an individual asks a question repeatedly about their thought of worry. So for example, if they're worried something bad is going to happen, like that they're going to get sick and die, they might repeatedly ask their parent if they're going to get sick. And the reality is, right, when you're asking these questions, they're not information-seeking questions. They're questions that are aimed at reducing anxiety, and they're often questions that aren't answerable. They don't have an answer, or the individual who's being asked to answer the question isn't qualified. So if I were to say, you know, Stu, I'm feeling really nauseous right now. Do you think I'm going to get sick? And you were to like, well, of course you're not going to get sick, Ryan. That's going to make me feel better. But can you really know if I'm going to get sick or not?
No.
And that's the hard thing, because of course we want to be able to reassure someone that something bad isn't going to happen like that. But it's not really, the real answer is, I'm not sure. I hope you don't, but I can't be certain. And so I kind of, when I'm working with parents with kids, I kind of frame it, if you find that you're kind of lying or giving an answer that isn't necessarily the truth, or you don't really have the answer for, just to make someone feel better, that's a clue in right there that that's reassurance. And I think that's a really common one. I think other ways is actually providing individuals access to items they might use to feel better. So when we think about germ contamination OCD, you know, buying excessive amounts of soap or toiletries is a really common one that happens. So there can be a number of behaviors. Actually, any behavior can actually turn into family accommodation, but they're always intended to essentially get rid of somebody's anxiety or distress. And it's at the expense of being able to do what you want to do in the moment.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. That was great. And I guess managing family accommodation is important, because like you said, you're working with a client and they're making progress in the session, but then if they go home and then suddenly they're getting reassured, or there's an abundance of soap if contamination is the issue, whatever it is, then that could undo or undermine the treatment. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. So essentially what happens is when you're providing accommodation. It offers temporary reduction or escape from anxiety, but it actually ends up preventing the individual from learning that anxiety is transient, meaning that it dissipates over time. We actually don't have to do anything with anxiety for it to naturally go away on its own. It often prevents the family member from learning that avoidance strengthens and reinforces fear. So the more you avoid a situation that makes you anxious, you never learn to be in that situation, be able to do the thing you want and tolerate those uncomfortable thoughts and feelings. So it ends up being a vicious cycle where I frame it as family accommodation replaces the compulsions in the cognitive behavioral model for OCD. And so what happens is you're the one responsible for taking away the individual's anxiety. And then what happens is you have to engage in more and more behaviors and more family accommodation over time.
So that then, I guess, puts more stress both on the person with OCD and more stress on the people around him or her. In the wider family system, which isn't going to help anyone. But I guess it comes from a good place of trying to help, but ultimately some OCD is kind of a, what's the word, paradox?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's like this paradoxical intention, right? The idea that, you know, your mind tricks you into thinking you have to do something to get rid of anxiety, when in fact doing the complete opposite of what OCD is demanding of you is actually what leads you to be able to live a productive and meaningful life. Right. So there is OCD is kind of like a liar. It's telling you a lot of lies about how you need to behave in the world in order to be able to do the things you want.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so what are some of the more positive in the sense of constructive or effective ways that families can support their loved ones with OCD?
I mean, I think the first step is to connect with a therapist who specializes in OCD, specifically using exposure and response prevention treatment. And because what happens is if you just start reducing family accommodation, it's going to be really distressing for everyone. And it needs to be really graded and controlled. So you need to be working with a trained therapist to essentially start to identify, okay, what are the behaviors I'm seeing? You know, what are the things that my loved one is asking of me to do, and what is the function of that behavior? And collaborating then together with the therapist and the patient to identify what are the things they're willing to gradually reduce over time. So if it's reassurance and you're asking 20 reassurance questions a day, maybe we start with, we're only going to answer 15 of those questions. And then after that, we're going to respond by saying, you know, it sounds like that's your OCD and I'm not willing to answer that because I know it's not going to help in the long term, but I'm here with you and I'm willing to sit with you through that while we sit with not knowing whether or not this feared outcome is going to happen. And I think being consistent across family members is important, to always be framing this as accommodation doesn't help in the long term and we need to learn how to ride this out together. So being firm and empathetic is really important. It kind of goes back to basic parenting skills. Like, how do you set a limit that, you know, is going to cause a lot of anxiety and distress and hold to that limit and not give in to the OCD? And what happens is at first we have what's known as an extinction burst. We get a lot of different types of behaviors, yelling, screaming, crying, isolating. And it feels so awful to sit there through that with them. But then when you do it the second and the third and the fourth time, eventually that comes down and it no longer bothers them. And then you can say, okay, now we're going to do 10 questions. And the same could be true for anything else. If it's showering, it's like, we're only going to give you 2 pumps of soap instead of 4. And after that, no more. And we got to ride that out together. So really coming up with a list, right, of all of the different ways in which the family's accommodating, the demands that are being placed on the parent or caregiver, and then starting to gradually work on coming up with a plan to resist doing those things, and training parents how to respond in a way that's validating, but not reassuring.
Yeah. Yeah, really good points. And on that point that you said there about being validating without reassuring, this is something I've heard before of how, because the empathetic response is when they're asked for reassurance is to kind of give it. That's the common sense, what most people would think to do, right? But we know with OCD that's not necessarily going to help. So how do parents or family members, siblings, spouses, how do they kind of be there for that person without verbally reassuring the content, if that makes sense? Yeah,
I think that's a really good question. I think it actually varies for person to person, and you kind of have to work with the individual to figure out what's the best prompt they can use in the moment that doesn't seem fake or inauthentic or not genuine. But ones I've noticed are, I usually start with collaborating with the individual and having the parent ask the child, like, you know, this sounds like an OCD question. Do you think this is one we could hold off on? Like, would it be okay if I didn't answer that? And what you're doing is you're building space between anxiety hits. I feel this extreme need to get reassurance immediately. And by just saying, just labeling that as OCD, like, this sounds like an OCD question. And I know when we answer these, it doesn't help in the long term. What do you think we could do instead? Like, could I not answer that today? It almost creates this space for the individual to check in and say, you know what, you're right. You know, that is my OCD. And could we wait 5 minutes? Let's see where I'm at in 5 or 10 minutes. And if I'm still really struggling, maybe then you can answer it. And it starts on that end. But then over time, we get to a point where we get the individual to buy into the parent essentially just saying, like, we know this is reassurance and it doesn't work, so I'm not going to answer that. Or giving them specific prompts to say, like, I'm not really sure, and I don't think I can really answer that question. And I think if I did that, that wouldn't really help you anyways, because it wouldn't be truthful of me. And so what you're doing is you're not invalidating their experience of it's hard. You're labeling that it's hard. You're saying, I know this is really hard for you. And we know that if I do this right now, it's not going to help. And it creates a framework to then be able to sit with the discomfort and move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Okay, and do you ever encourage like written contracts between, say, parents and child, or person with OCD and partner? Is that ever useful to say, if I ask you reassurance, you have every right to say no, or whatever it is?
I would say I don't do formal written contracts in that way. I think I try to take a more collaborative approach where in the session we essentially agree that there will be times that the patient is going to allow their partner or their parent to not answer certain questions, and they do come up with that agreement in session. So in a way it's more of a verbal contract, yeah. I think. I don't like to use punishment at all. I just don't think it's that effective. But what I find is, like, you know, with younger children, you can say, if you're able to not ask me these questions, you know, 2 days out of the 7 days this week, you can earn a prize. You know, you can get this special reward at the end of the day. And then we increase the amount of times to do so. We're reinforcing and rewarding them for not giving into OCD. Rather than punishing them, because when you punish them for doing it, it's kind of like you're blaming them, right?
Yeah.
You're not really blaming OCD anymore. And, you know, it sets you in a tricky situation where the individual starts to not separate their OCD from them and starts to feel like they're responsible for essentially their OCD.
Yeah, really good point. Okay, so you mentioned there how families can get involved with treatment. Is that you bring them into the session, and at what point do you usually bring family or family members into a session?
Yeah, so for me, it depends. So when I'm working with children and adolescents, I always incorporate the family. I think if you don't, you don't make progress. And I do it one of two ways. Either I do it where the parent is always in the session with the child for each session, and I'll always start that way, especially for assessment. So sometimes I'll meet with the family first for one or two sessions before meeting the child. Other times I meet with them all together. And then for cases where there's, you know, really, you know, severe OCD, where somebody is engaging in rituals for greater than, say, you know, 4 hours per day and up, I meet with the parents actually every other week, and I meet with the kid weekly. So I'm always essentially framing, developing a plan with the individual, making sure the parent's aware of the plan and knows how to respond, and then teaching the parent specific interventions to coach their child through the exposure and not provide reassurance, and then give them an outlet with me to be able to voice their own concerns and their own worries and fears that show up when they start to reduce the family accommodation within the home.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And, you know, any families or people that have loved ones of OCD, they're listening right now and they want to kind of learn more about how to accommodate less and do more of these healthier behaviors. What sort of things can they do to better educate themselves on it?
I think the first step is to learn everything you can about OCD. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the International OCD Foundation has great resources about OCD. And there's books out there as well. You know, there's different books on family accommodation that people can get that really outline it and give specific strategies for how to gradually reduce it. And I think, you know, other things to think about too is that to always remind yourself that it will get better.
Yeah.
And there is help out there. And the sooner you can get yourself connected with a provider who specializes in OCD, and the more you can learn about it, once you get the hang of it and you start applying it, it gets worse at first, of course, like anything, right? Whenever you're changing a behavior, but it gets better over time. And I've seen people who have been completely debilitated, not being able to go to school or not being able to go to work. And within 6 months, they're back at work and they're back functioning again. But you have to do the work, and you have to sit with a lot of anxiety and distress, which, to be honest, as a society, we're not well cultured to do.
No.
We're not taught to tolerate distress in any capacity. So, you know, when you're asking somebody to reduce family accommodation, it goes against the societal grain. It goes against what you've learned in your family system, and it goes against what your initial instinct is. But if you do it, and you lean into the discomfort, it does get better.
Yeah, yeah, great description. Okay, so OCD is very tough for the person with it, but it can also be tough for the family and anyone surrounding that person. How can families better support themselves so then they're able, A, take care of themselves, but B, then take better care of the person with OCD?
I think the first thing is to set really firm boundaries. So if you're, you know, it goes back to that kind of behavioral contract idea of what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do in the moment to accommodate the OCD. And I think using your own support system outside of your loved one to be able to talk about how it affects you and the strain it puts on your own relationship, and being clear about that with your partner, with your child as well. Because I think we don't want to avoid talking about how OCD affects the home. We really want to pull it to the forefront, and we want to start to identify, you know, what are the ways it gets in the way of being able to have relationships, and then start to take that time to step back and think it through and work together with the individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And with your clients, more of a general question now, is what do you notice in the clients that seem to just take to ERP more than others or see more results quicker from it?
I think it varies from person to person. I think most people respond to exposure therapy, and we do know that from the data that's out there. I think what we run into is adherence to treatment and buy into the rationale for exposure therapy. So if you're working with an individual and you're trying to teach them this concept of accepting unwanted thoughts and feelings and committing to values-based actions, even when they're anxious, and they have this control agenda of needing to get rid of anxiety before engaging in meaningful things in their life, then that can be a barrier to then being willing to do exposure. And other things can be where you have the individual who buys into it, but their family system doesn't. And so they're getting mixed messages. You know, they, on the one hand, they're trying to learn how to show up and face their fear and not engage in a compulsion. And someone in their immediate family maybe is telling them the opposite, or giving them advice that isn't necessarily useful or helpful that can interfere in them accessing the treatment or following through with it. And that's why it's important to bring the family into treatment. And being very clear about the rationale for exposure and making sure everybody understands how OCD is maintained over time and how compulsions and family accommodation don't work in the long term.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. That was great. And for bringing it to the back to the family system. Okay, so just general sort of words of hope for anyone listening that has OCD.
I think my main words of advice would be hang in there, keep doing what you're doing, and be courageous. In my work with people with OCD, I have never seen or met more courageous and brave individuals in my life. These are people that show up every day with intense, intrusive thoughts or worries that really debilitate them and hold them down. And they show up and they get up every day and they show up in the room and they say, I'm not going to give in today. I'm going to do this. And to see somebody show up and do what the opposite of what everything in their body is telling them to do and ride it out is admirable. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to see. And for anybody who's feeling really overwhelmed, I think knowing that the only way to get better is by moving through the pain and suffering. And that is not a hallmark to OCD. That is part of being a human. And part of living life is knowing that we all have things that are challenging. And we show up and we do them anyways. And when we do that, we stand in a place where we feel empowered and we become resilient. And maybe that anxiety doesn't go down, but you're able to do what you want even when it shows up. And that's the place where I really encourage everybody to stand. And they can. We all can.
Yeah, great words. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so a very different question now is if you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell him?
Ooh, that's a challenging question. I'd probably tell him to let things unfold as they are and not try to control or change things or try to make things happen. I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I want to know when things are going to happen, how they're going to happen. And I find that the more I get stuck in needing things to be perfect and needing to prove my own self-worth, that I actually start to close myself off from opportunities that I probably never would have imagined myself coming into. And sometimes you just have to take life for the ride and let things unfold as they come.
Yeah, very much so. Cool. So you've got a billboard in Rhode Island. What do you want written on that billboard?
The first thing that came up to my mind was change is inevitable. Then I'm not sure what that means, but that's what showed up.
Cool. Well, yeah. Well, thank you for being honest. What comes to your mind? I like that. Yeah, change is inevitable. Okay. And is there anything else today that you wish you could have shared that I haven't asked you?
I think, you know, if the one thing I could share, and I don't think it's anything new, is that to not avoid things that you're afraid of. I think the more we avoid, the smaller our world becomes. And we don't get to bring all of our wonderful, great attributes into the world. And I've worked with lots of people, and everyone I've met has something to offer the world. And it's really scary to be vulnerable and show up and not avoid situations that make us anxious. But when we do, I think we're a better society and we work better as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, inspiring words. All right, thank you so much, Ryan, for going over family accommodation. I agree with you. I think the family system is so important to people's recovery. So thank you for giving it the time and your knowledge to answer it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So there you have it. Thank you to Ryan for his time and for you guys for listening. And if this has been helpful, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast, as it helps me reach more people. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Until we speak, take care.